This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to take up a subject that I think is of utmost interest, which is cardiovascular prevention, and specifically, we're going to hone in on the cholesterol controversy. We're going to look at supplements that lower cholesterol. Today, with us, one of our favorite go-to experts on the subject of nutrition is Dr. Thomas Williams. Dr. Williams has done some great podcasts with us on the subject of the adrenals. Most recently, he talked to us about supplements for the immune system. He has a wide variety of publications with the Point Institute. You can find that at pointinstitute.org. He also has a popular book called The Original Prescription, but he has written some great encyclopedic books on subjects like Functional Strategies for the Management of Gastrointestinal Disorders. That book is like a Bible to me because I treat a lot of patients with those problems. Also, Supporting Immune Function, Lifestyle and Nutrient Approach, and other subjects as well, all available at pointinstitute.org. Today, though, we're going to focus on cardiovascular prevention. So a little background on Dr. Williams. Dr. Williams is someone who is a PhD, earned his doctorate from Medical College of Wisconsin, where he studied molecular immunology. And since 1996, he's been spending his time studying the mechanisms and actions of natural-based therapies. He's also an expert in the therapeutic deployment of nutritional supplements. He's VP of Science and Regulatory Affairs for a great company that makes supplements exclusively for doctors to dispense to their patients. It's called Ortho Molecular. And he is responsible for developing a lot of their great products. He teaches the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy. And, you know, if I said everything he does, I'd simply run out of time and then the interview would be over. So let's get to the point. It's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Williams.
It's really great to be back with you again. This is a very important topic, as you know, yes, in health.
Indeed. Okay, so you know, frame the subject for us because you know, there seems to be a single-minded approach to cardiovascular prevention, which involves a heavy reliance on, well, a couple of drugs. In fairness, I mean, there's several drugs that are used. There's the statins, extremely popular, multi-billion-dollar industry, tens of millions of Americans taking them. It's thought that you know, virtually a third of the population are candidates for taking them. That's controversial. And then there's blood thinners, like aspirin, for example. So are we overly narrowly focused on cardiovascular prevention with the agents available?
Well, you know, this is a huge topic, as you know, and it's been debated actually for now and going on several decades. But clearly there was a relationship, and still I think there is a relationship between atherosclerosis, specifically you know, the formation of plaques in the arteries, and lipid deposits. And, of course, those originally were defined very clearly with heavy amounts of cholesterol. So that early connection between cholesterol particularly and heart attacks, atherosclerosis, and formation of plaques seemed to be fairly clear in you know, when you look at old data going back numbers of decades, including animal studies, which the original studies were on these cholesterol fed rabbits. And of course, when they fed these rabbits cholesterol, lo and behold, they got all these plaques and, you know, the equivalent of atherosclerosis. And so sort of we had this hypothesis, the cholesterol hypothesis.
This was unfortunately, Dr. Anishka, a Russian physiologist way back, I think it was in the 20s.
Exactly. Well, there was a number of different things, but yeah, we're talking in the early 20s and all the way through the 50s, and sort of this was sort of this you know, what they thought was the golden model, or you know, the golden situation where you could invoke the disease, sort of like you had when you could take like smallpox and give it to someone. Now you can give cholesterol and give it to them, sort of like the, you know, you've proven the point. And unfortunately, what we've learned about that is that was a very simplistic understanding of cholesterol. Since then, we've still stuck on that idea, and the large epidemiological studies have basically looked for cholesterol and the various components or the various lipoproteins that carry cholesterol and triglycerides, the so-called LDL or the bad cholesterol and the HDL, the so-called good cholesterol. And, you know, unfortunately, we've had decades and decades of data, epidemiological data, that's cataloged, you know, the amounts of risk in patients with elevated LDL or low HDL or total cholesterol or triglycerides. And because we haven't looked at a lot of other things, that's sort of narrowly where we have calculated the risk. And as you mentioned, because we have drugs that then can lower or modify those particular biomarkers, we have, you know, then we have a treatment model that we can then test. And indeed, if you do look at the clinical literature, when you reduce LDL cholesterol in people with high amounts of it, you do lower their risk. So it seems to be a kind of a neat sort of story all tied up in a bow, but yet it's that bigger picture. And when we start looking beyond that, when we start realizing there's more to the story than cholesterol, it's about the particles. Are they oxidized? What size are the particles? Are they actually atherogenic? Are they in, you know, what's going on? Are the proteins on these lipoprotein particles important? We start getting into a number of other questions, and we realize that, you know, we can modify risk if we change or in this case lower LDL cholesterol, but in many cases we want to look beyond that and look at other factors. As you know, the atherosclerotic process is really more of an immune inflammatory process, and sort of LDL cholesterol and some of these oxidized LDL cholesterol particles sort of get caught up in the mix of that, and are not really causative necessarily, but maybe are associative. And when we start looking beyond that, we realize that there's a lot we can do rather than just merely measuring LDL cholesterol and then treating it, especially with a statin. And as we might get into, obviously, statins are not at all without risk. There's quite a bit of risk that's associated with them.
Mm-hmm. So if I get you right, and I've heard you speak on the subject, you're not inalterably opposed to a strategy of lowering cholesterol where appropriate, I think is the, you know, those are the key words there, because to take someone who has a marginally high cholesterol and very little risk and to prescribe willy-nilly a medication that might have a lot of side effects, the risks outweigh the relatively small potential benefits.
Well, yeah, I think the idea is we should know what someone's cholesterol, various lipid numbers are, including the more broad picture of the lipoprotein particles, and that should be taken into context, meaning we need that information, and we need to understand how does that relate to their overall risk, and rather than what we've seen, you know, the classic ATP, you know, 1, 2, and 3 guidelines that basically said measure LDL cholesterol if it's above a certain number, and of course that number kept changing, but whatever it was, you know, then target that number and, you know, do that essentially with a statin or perhaps some other drug, but the statin has now become sort of the go-to way to do that. What I'm saying, and what I'm sure what you are advocating, is understanding that number. And oftentimes when it's extremely high, it might suggest that something else is going on, like some sort of genetic familial hypercholesterolemia or something like that. We certainly want to know what's going on there, but that the LDL cholesterol number is not the end-all, be-all way to measure risk in patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll give you an example is that, you know, I was curious. I looked at these new guidelines, the ATP or ATTP guidelines, which every time they put out these guidelines, it seems like they further extend the criteria for putting people on statins. It's never, you know, that they're going to narrow the criteria. They always kind of widen the net. And so I said, well, let me plug in my own numbers. You know, I'm a male. I'm 64. I do have some family history of cardiovascular disease, but I'm athletic. I just had an EBT heart scan, which showed that I had a zero calcium score. But I put in my height, my weight, my cholesterol, my smoking history, which is I smoked a couple of years in college, you know, and put all that information into this little algorithm that conveniently is provided by American Heart Association. And it spit out, you need to be on a moderate to heavy statin regimen, which I found singularly inappropriate because, right. You know, it just wasn't tailored to my individual circumstances.
Well, and the even the more problematic issue with the new guidelines, which have sort of abandoned the ATP model, and it's the new ACC, American Heart Association guidelines, their essential view is that you look for risk, and in this case, the risk is not even determined by LDL cholesterol anymore. It's based on family history or previous MI or if you're a diabetic, et cetera, or this risk score that you plugged in. You plug in the number, and basically it tells you, it doesn't tell you your risk. It basically says, should you be on a statin or not, and what dose of a statin should you be on? And because they're no longer indexed to LDL cholesterol like they used to be back in the ATP3 days, there's no time limit when you should be off of them, meaning if you went on because you were at risk, there's no target to reach for you to go off the statin. So essentially it answers the question, when do I go off my statin? Well, according to the new guidelines, never.
Yeah.
Because the reasons you were put on them can never be changed in most cases.
It's a little bit
problematic.
I've dubbed this cholesterol limbo. It's like, it's like that dance craze of the 1950s with Chubby Checker. How low can you go under the bar? The lower the better, according to some cardiologists. They may want to get your LDL 30 or less, you know, which is pretty extreme.
Right. And, of course, you know, the things that we've learned in the last 5 years or so, and, of course, the black box warning that was put on statins not too long ago was, in particular, the increased risk for diabetes. And I just pulled this today. A paper just came out looking at about 20 observational studies since 2004 through 2016, and they basically have showed a 44% increase in subjects that are taking statins with a new onset type 2 diabetes compared to those people not given statins. And the reason this is 44% is pretty high.
Especially in women, for some reason. And perversely, it's that very population where the benefits of statins are somewhat dubious in older women.
And if you look at this, you know, when this was first brought up and a lot of the clinical trialists said, well, you know, we should ignore this, it's not a big deal, it was about 15 to 20%. But that was in the clinical trials where you can control the patients coming in. These are observational studies of people on this. You know, the people coming into your office aren't, you know, perfectly fit for a clinical trial. Oftentimes, as you know, put on a statin and may have a higher risk for diabetes than the group they would have initially brought into a clinical trial for statins in the first place.
Yep.
So when we see what's happening in real life, you look at Lipitor and Crestor, which are, you know, the more potent ones, they have even a higher risk, you know, a 49 and a 61% increase risk for being on that statin and being a type 2 diabetic. So now cynically, some of these cardiologists will say, well, because diabetes is a reason to put you on a statin, it's almost like I'm pre-treating you. in a sense that, you know, I give you the statin, you become a diabetic. Well, it doesn't matter, because if you become a diabetic, I was going to give you a statin anyway. It's a little bit of a cynical, right? So the problem with that is clearly there's something metabolically going on when you're doing this, which is exacerbating the ability for them to control their blood sugar, which is a problem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if we can, you know, thinking about this, one of the big, you know, even if we don't like the fact that lipids are still the primary biomarker for measuring risk for cardiovascular disease, even though, you know, there's other things like CRP and homocysteine and some of these other factors we'd like to look at, ironically, the natural medicine world that have been scouring the world looking for potential ways to reduce cardiovascular risk, they're sort of still stuck with these same biomarkers, meaning there's sort of this expectation that if you find something in nature that is going to modify cardiovascular risk, you know, the first thing you're going to look at is, what does it do to cholesterol? What does it do to LDL, HDL, triglycerides, sort of the standard sort of things, because, first of all, they're easy to measure, and they're sort of the expected targets to look at. So, ironically, even though we want to move away from some of these targets, you know, and look at more broadly, we're still sort of stuck with those as data points for a lot of the sort of the natural and even lifestyle-based remedies. What are they looking at? They're looking at cholesterol, triglycerides, et cetera, in the blood. So it's kind of an irony in some ways that we're kind of stuck with.
So a lot of people are leery of taking statins, especially the folks who come to see me in an integrative clinic. I come to me and I'm the tell me it ain't so doc. They say, I've been told I need to go on a statin, but I'd like an alternative. And of course, our primary tools are diet and lifestyle. But let's say people max out on exercise and a clean diet, which actually isn't necessarily a low cholesterol diet, it turns out. It's a relatively high number of people respond to a low carb diet. What's out there that provides a natural alternative when cholesterol lowering is a priority?
Well, maybe I go in the opposite direction. One that's very popular that I think is problematic, and I've just recently written an article on this, is red yeast rice.
Yep.
Red yeast rice is, by some people's definition, a natural statin or some sort of statin alternative that they can use. And if you know the history behind red yeast rice, you know that the active ingredient that was originally found in red yeast rice is actually a statin. It's actually the original lovastatin, which was approved as a drug.
Mevacor, in
1987. As it turns out, there are a number of different yeast and fungi that, when you give them a regular substrate, in this case, red yeast, a rice, a fermentation of rice from red yeast, a yeast called Monascus purpureus, you get this fermentation and you get these compounds called monocolins. Monocolin K in particular is lovastatin. Now with the drug companies, they actually use fermentation of another yeast, aspergillus, and they are able to produce high volumes of this monocolin K or lovastatin, and that's what they produce as a drug, but it's really the same compound. And without getting into too much of the regulatory history, FDA deemed almost 15 years ago or longer that compound, monocolin K, found in red yeast rice, is an unapproved drug because they have already approved lovastatin. Mm-hmm. And when I tell people that, you know, well, they say to me all the time, well, we can still find it out there. There's red yeast rice out there. Well, FDA kind of created this little gray area. They said, yes, you can sell a product called, quote, red yeast rice, but it can't have any of its active ingredient in it. Otherwise, it's an unapproved drug. And so it really has created.
If I could just summarize, what they're saying is, if you offer it in a less efficacious form, as long as it's not really going to work, it's okay to market it. That's kind of a bass-ackwards way.
And unfortunately, what some companies have said is, well, maybe there's a loophole. They said, well, maybe we can just put the product out there. Maybe it can still have its active ingredient. We just won't label it. We won't say how much is in there, and hopefully FDA won't test it. Mm-hmm. Well, as it turns out, people have done that, and you know, there's been several different papers over the years that have looked at what's available online or, you know, commercially, and turns out some products have nothing, some products have 1 milligram, some products have up to 10 milligrams. And so you have this big range, and guess what? All of them say nothing, meaning they, none of them actually specify how much is on the label, so you would never know unless you have a little chemistry lab at home that you could measure that. And so the problem is we're left with products that we have no idea what the efficacy of those products are that are being sold in the U.S. market, and that includes even some professional grade companies have decided to maybe, well, we'll whisper in the doctor's ear how many milligrams are in there. Very obviously a nebulous sort of gray area way to sell a product. So we have been, and so the paper I wrote is a white paper that anybody can download off my Point of Stew website, entitled "Are Red Yeast Rice Supplements Safe and Effective Alternatives to Statin Therapy?" And so it lays out some of these regulatory issues and why we typically don't recommend the products.
But also the fact that they may contain varying amounts of the active ingredient means, and I've seen this, some patients who have difficulty with statins, they say, well, I'm going to try red yeast rice. They try red yeast rice, and they have the same identical side effects, like muscle aches and pains, which some people are susceptible to when they take statins. So, and I've actually seen a couple of patients develop liver problems similar to those that we see when people take high-dose prescription statin medication.
That has been recorded in literature. We see less of it, probably because most of the products have low doses. But you do see sporadic cases of not only that, but you also see sporadic cases of CoQ10 deficiency as a result of red yeast rice, and that's been shown in both humans and animal studies. So, while it's not common because the products are typically very low dose, it's possible. So it's really a gamble to kind of pick one out of a hat to decide if it's going to work or not.
There's another issue with that is that the fermentation process is a little squirrely, and it generates many compounds, not just monoclonal K, the cholesterol-lowering agent, but also certain potentially toxic compounds. Is that something that the research has revealed in some of these over-the-counter products?
Yeah, so that particular issue where you have some of these, negative toxins that are in the citrulline is the one that most people look at as a mycotoxin that are found in some red yeast rice products. For the most part, most of the products that are available today, the companies have recognized that is a problem. So ironically, while they don't test their products for the active ingredient, they often will tell you that they test it for citrulline, for which they say it's absent.
Okay.
And for the most part, that particular issue is no longer the case. We probably don't see as much of that as we saw 10 years ago. But the bigger issue today is still the problem with the active ingredient or the lack thereof.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Our listeners know that we divide these podcasts into two parts. So in part two, let's continue our discussion of things that work to lower cholesterol, things that don't work to lower cholesterol, and maybe some alternative pathways to cardiovascular prevention. We're talking today to Dr. Thomas Williams. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.